Good morning. Well, everyone gets quiet. I guess it's time to start. I'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session from Mesa City Council for Thursday, October 25th, 2012. And Councilwoman Higgins, you on the phone?
Good morning.
Oh, she is. So Councilwoman Dina Higgins is joining us by phone. I guess everyone else is here. We'll begin today's meeting with the first item, and this is a really great item to go over because we have some very special guests this morning. Mr. Jeb Janiak, you want to come on up and introduce our guests? We, just as everyone's getting settled, we had a great day yesterday here in Mesa with the announcement of the selection of the Barry and Peggy Goldwater Library and Archives of a site here in downtown Mesa. And so the announcement was yesterday. The formal part of it, I guess, starts today. And Bill Jibjaniak, if you would introduce our special guests this morning.
Thank you, Mayor. It is a great day after yesterday, and let me start with some introductions. Right here on my left, Michael Goldwater, son of Barry and Peggy, and Peggy Goldwater Clay, obviously daughter of Senator and Peggy. Ms. Judy Eisenhower, who was the Senator's chief of staff for a period of time. And to my immediate right is Doug Sador, who is the architect with this great design, who's been involved here for quite some time, actually, from what I'm learning along the way. What I'd like to do is some of this is a rehash and get a chance for everybody to interact this morning is quickly step through a couple of slides that we had. And I know that yesterday a lot of this was presented. We are looking for next steps and the direction that we're going to be taking from council. So let me, if I can, just step through a little bit of that. And let's see if we can get the next one right up here. Nice screen. Judy, would you take a minute while the technology is catching up with us here a little bit and talk a little bit about the vision that you have for the library and what is the background a little bit and explain with council and the public a little bit what's it all about?
This project started with a lady named Mary Del Pritzlaff, whom you probably will remember as the mother-in-law of former Governor Fife Symington. She and Senator and Mrs. Goldwater and her husband, John, were very close friends, and she many times would chair one of his political committees. And she and my husband, Earl, were visiting one day about the senator and his papers and what's happening to them, and we discovered his papers were sitting in boxes. This did not sit well with this lady, and she said, well, we've got to do something about this. And so she and Earl came up with the idea of building a library and archives to preserve not only the Goldwater papers, but all papers from not only congressional leaders, but also Arizona history. Senator Goldwater was very much a history buff. And if you wanted to learn about Arizona history, you asked him, because he knew as a very young man in getting into political life, he traveled the state with slides that he had taken of the state and would present these to children in schools. And so that's actually how, excluding the Goldwater name for the department stores, that's how his name was pretty much widespread throughout the state because of showing of these slides. One day he was down at in Cochise County, down in actually Tombstone. And the building had literally fallen down. And so he was walking through the rubble and discovered these books, which are about this big, very thick leather. It was the trial of, Wyatt Earp, thank you. And I was fortunate enough to see them, and they were written in this beautiful script. Well, that's what started him on preserving Arizona history. And through the years, he discovered that other universities, et cetera, were coming over here and partaking of taking our history back to their universities. The Arizona history and Senator Goldwater spread throughout the United States, and that is one project that we have that is going to be ongoing. We intend to preserve all of Arizona history from congressional, our congressman all the way back to statehood. We have pieces here, pieces there, and we just want to put them all under one roof. And this is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization, and we will certainly need the help of everyone to get this going.
Excellent. Thank you. Doug, if would you take a minute here and talk a little bit about the site and your vision for the particular location in the building and some of the characteristics that you've designed into this.
Thank you, Bill. As you know, we're proposing the site to be at the southeast corner of McDonald and First Avenue in downtown Mesa. We view it as somewhat of a transitional site between the core of downtown Mesa with its taller structures to the north and the smaller, lower-scale structures to the south. We also view the site as a prime opportunity, as a catalyst for redevelopment of the immediate city block called South Center Campus, as well as properties you may find across McDonald to the west and to the north. The building, as we're proposing it, would really hold tight to that intersection and therefore be very respectful of your newly adopted form-based zoning in terms of minimal setbacks, streetscape improvements, and envisioned massing or volume of the building and how it addresses the street. The structure itself is being proposed to be approximately 40,000 square feet in phase one with three stories. It would have a height of approximately 65 feet. So we've stretched the floor-to-floor dimensions a bit because of the internal functions and the flexibility needed. Once you understand that a little bit better. Let's see what else. We probably will provide about 40 parking spaces to the south of the structure. There would be an expansion in the future, which would increase the original square footage by approximately 25%, which maybe adds 10 to 12,000 square feet. That's mostly driven by the need for additional archival storage as time goes on. We're also coordinating now very closely with the senior housing project to the immediate east in terms of potentially sharing a common drive that gives access out to First Avenue. There's some pedestrian linkages we'd like to reinforce and develop a continuity between the two projects. Also, before the addition arrives, there's then that footprint that sits temporarily there for a number of years. We want to make sure that it's done in a finished way right from the beginning. You're looking at an image on First Avenue as looking to the west. It starts to suggest the overall volumes and the character. Many influences are being played out in the character, but just to touch on one, we took a look at Senator Goldwater's photography over the decades and started to understand how he framed particular views, not unlike how the building can do that. How he composed various shots, how he focused on strong forms, contrasting shadows, he leaned toward textures and certain ruggedness in those images, and I can see that subliminally influencing the exterior envelope for this building. We are proposing a tough, durable, long-lasting skin. Specifically concrete. We're exploring whether it's cast in place or precast architectural concrete or a mix of those. Might be integrally colored like a taupe, so it's kind of a warm, sophisticated coloration. The texture might be a horizontally board-formed concrete, so it plays in those textures and those patterns, shadows throughout. You'll notice that this image that the first level is mostly glazed full height for its entire length as it fronts on First Avenue. That's totally intentional at addressing your desire for an active streetscape. And we would program the interior floor plan so we'd line up those uses that would help activate that, specifically a cafe, the main lobby, the entry, a gift shop, and some changing galleries. Those uses that fall behind that or above that are less needing to be displayed on the street and show that kind of activity. And the other view is looking east down First Avenue. This is how it would address the corner. You're starting to sense that it's a very sculpted, organic, composed piece. I remember reading the books about Senator Goldwater and some of his travels, and he really had an affinity for the Colorado River and its canyons. And I have many images of when I went down it, that there was this kind of layering of the topography and geology. And so, again, subliminally, we're maybe thinking that plays out here as well. It's a wall-like architecture, which is more appropriate for the Southwest. We really minimize glazing. We're already moving toward a very energy-efficient building. In that regard, we are interested in pursuing LEED certification at probably the silver or gold level. For those who don't know, that's the leadership in environmental design, environmental and energy conscious design, which is sponsored by the U.S. Green Building Council out of Washington, D.C. It can be a challenge with this particular type of structure because there'll be very stringent temperature and humidity controls with some of the archival storage. One technical piece we might touch on, which is kind of fun, within the archival storage area, which is a three-story volume within the interior of the plant, it would accommodate an automated archival retrieval system to where you can, in fact, go to a website, pre-order a bin number, whatever it may be. The cranes and mechanisms will quickly retrieve it within minutes and have it staged there for you, so upon your arrival as a scholar or a student, it's ready to go. So we will be exploiting all kinds of state-of-the-art technologies throughout the building, particularly the mechanical systems as well, lighting. The list goes on. Lots of other details, but hopefully that gives you kind of a feel for what we're thinking and where we want to go.
Doug, what's the finish on the exterior there?
That's mostly the concrete.
Concrete. Yeah.
It's integrally colored to a warm color.
Right.
We're probably avoiding a cool natural gray. And it would have that horizontal board-formed concrete.
Oh, okay.
So there's a texture to it. We believe it'll be a very dignified, sophisticated kind of finish for an archival structure like this. It's also addressing the need for a 100-year building. So all of the materials, systems, finishes will be very respectful of wanting this building to last a very long time.
Doug, do you want to talk a little bit about your board, your background, and the general floor plan? And this is certainly a start. This isn't finalized, but you've laid out a lot of different movements there.
I can go on for 30 minutes, but
well,
I don't want to do that. Would you like me to walk through the plan? Or is there time for that?
You want the microphone with you?
Thank you. Are we on? Okay.
Yeah, you are.
Just quickly, I might walk through the three floor plans, ground level, second level, third level. North is up, so this is the First Avenue exposure across the top, and then McDonald would be off to your left as we go through the plans. We're proposing the entry on the north side. There was a thought at one time we'd move around the east end of the building to the parking. We already realized we want to make some changes, and there's many of them we're starting to collect, but the main entry might slide further west and be anchored right off of the intersection, which is a much better urban design gesture. But within the orange zone you see here, it'd be changing galleries, gift shop, cafe, public restrooms. Accessible right off the lobby would be the very tall three-story reading room, which has mezzanines wrapping around it on three sides, and it relates directly out to an interior courtyard, which is here, which is similarly proportioned in terms of its size and height. So we view that as kind of one singular spatial experience once you're within the library. The courtyard obviously becomes a point of orientation as you move through the entire plan at all three levels. It also introduces a tremendous amount of daylighting to all of the interior spaces and really opens it up. This is the archival storage, which you see on all three plans, which is that three-story volume with the big retrieval machine inserted within it. These are really supportive spaces to the south, the processing of the materials as they come in, protecting them, humidifying them, freezing them, whatever's needed. Mechanicals are at the southeast corner and are stacked up on all three levels.
Moving up to the second level, permanent exhibits, some meeting rooms of varying sizes, the upper level of the reading area, courtyard. We are proposing a Taiwanese Cultural Center because they may be stepping up with some serious funding. And so they'd have a place to exhibit some of their artifacts and some officing there. And more supportive functions along the south. Third level, administrative suite up above the corner. The tall lobby space, large multi-use space, and this is Judy's party deck for the grand opening, and many other events, of course, going to occur there as well. Capping off the reading room, more courtyard, archival storage. We also put over here at the west end a 100-seat lecture hall for smaller venues. However, if they're larger, then we would very much hope to use the Mesa Arts Center in its venues for those purposes, and then more support along the south edge. A lot of other details. Here's some of Senator Goldwater's photography I was speaking to. Here's some of the specific materials, textures, colors. We're actually thinking of programming the glass in various subtle tints that would reflect, whether it be green for meeting or other colors for other uses in the building. So we've animated the exterior with the glazing as well. There are a few accent elements that you see sprinkled throughout. It's a gold anodized aluminum panel system. To the east, these are the knockout panels so we can extrude out the archival storage in the future. We also clad the conference room at the administrative suite as well. So those are some of the highlights. Many more details, but as time goes on, I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk about those as well. Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate that. And obviously, to carry out that vision, we need to turn to a little bit of funding. And Michael Peggy, would you like to address some of the thoughts on fundraising and where you're going with some of that in the future?
Basically, we need to raise about $30 million. But that's not the only collection we need. Well, the committee will be looking for current legislators to commit their papers to the library, and then we have to dive into garages and old museums to ascertain old politicians who are no longer with us for the building. It'll be a tremendous undertaking, but we're all prepared to do that.
Great. Thank you. Anything you want to add to that, Peggy, this morning?
We'll take any checks anybody wants to write right now.
Excellent.
No, as you know, we're going to start a capital campaign, and it's most important that we set up the right cabinet for that. So we're moving forward in picking out specific people that can help us achieve the goal of the $30 million dollars to raise the building, and hopefully we'll do that in a fairly short amount of time, and I think the money will probably keep coming in over the 4 years, but we'd like to at least come out with a huge amount as soon as possible.
I just checked my wallet, and after this meeting you will only be $29,999,997 short.
We'll take it.
Okay. Do you have a website set up or anything that people, if they want to find out on the foundation?
Yes, we do. It's Barry. It's what,
www.goldwaterlibrary.org.
I'm trying to think. That's actually the Barry and Peggy Goldwater Library and Archives, but it had to be shortened. It's barrygoldwaterlibrary.org.
Barry Goldwater Library.org.
Right.
Okay, great. They can get more information and find
and
out
if,
from there.
If you want to look at some of Dad's photographs, you can go to goldwaterphotos.com.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Great. Proposed timeline, real quickly. So we're headed towards a detailed memorandum of understanding. Working with Doug and a few others, we've got obviously fundraising is going to go on throughout the entire project, but they've initially projected that design and production of contract documents and construction actually late 14 through late 15, early 14 through late 15, excuse me, and then being moving in for January 16. As you know, with timelines, they're subject to change. So it's a great start. We need to start with some goals in mind. I think that's certainly it. And then for us, our next steps is obviously after the development of that formalized agreement, bring it back to you and looking to step that forward as they commence fundraising as well. And that's the entire presentation.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Alex.
Just an observation. Last night I had an opportunity to go with my family and grandkids to a large gathering, hundreds of people, for this beautiful weather that we're having. And then I found my family quickly abandoned me because every few steps I was stopped again and said, tell us about the exciting news and great coverage in the paper front page. And what I heard from the community is, what a wonderful win. We're so excited to have this here. Give us all the details. And very positively received in the community there in the Southeast Mesa area. So we're excited about it, and we appreciate all the patience and everything that we've seen and being able to come together with this effort. So thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
Councilman Kavanaugh.
Well, I grew up in the Midwest, so I wasn't really familiar with Arizona, and my first experience with Arizona was when I was in college and taking political science classes. And, of course, I learned about your dad and learned about Mo Udall and some of the other great people who have represented Arizona in Congress. And so you might say I'm a lifetime political science junkie. And so I'm going to have to help with fundraising because I want to reserve a study carol somewhere in the library there. So congratulations.
Thank you.
He didn't tell you he's also been a lifelong Democrat. So
it's okay.
So if he's excited about it, you know how excited we are about it.
I might add that Dad did contribute to Mo Udall's campaign 1 year.
I understand why. Vice Mayor.
Technical question. It's something that rang in my ear. They mentioned 40 parking spaces. I want to make sure, and I see John Wesley over your shoulder. John, is that taking advantage of the downtown area and the reduced parking and shared parking so that we're,
yes.
I think Dave Richens will probably fly out of his chair if we find out this is being overparked. He's smiling.
I say real loud. Yes, it is. As he mentioned, we're taking advantage of the form-based code and the shared parking arrangements that are provided for. So certainly.
The ratio is, I believe, 1 per 1,000 square feet, which is a vast improvement over the earlier draft.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. One thing that I think that you can't see there that we've taken pains to try and coordinate the two projects that will be built now. That has been easier said than done at times, as we know. But I think that one thing that we will all be proud of is that when they're completed, the street scene on First Avenue, I think, is going to be pretty spectacular because both projects have been designed with the urban form in mind, with the that this will not be a typical suburban type thing. You're going to get a massing and a flow that I think will complement both projects and that we're real excited about. I know we worked hard to try and we didn't start out this way, but at the end of the day, we worked real hard to coordinate how these two will sit, and with the church and those two, it's going to be a pretty exciting street scene, which I think will really serve as an example and as an incentive for others to follow that, and we'll see some exciting things go on there in that area.
Can't be too exciting there. It's a library. You have to be quiet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hey, Mayor, just speaking to that point, Doug on Tuesday met with the neighboring developer. I really started talking about coordination. I believe the plan is for the two of them to get together and really solidify a vision that works for everybody.
Well, that's important in an urban area. I think one thing that used to frustrate me as a developer is we tend to be focused on our parcel. You can't do that. You shouldn't do that anytime. We have a tendency of doing that even when we're out in cotton fields. Which is why we have a series, a patchwork, a quilt, where you have several independent developments that don't ever seem to flow together, and that's unfortunate. But in a downtown area, you've got to look at how the project fits in, not only with its immediate neighbors, but with the entire block. And we're learning on this. Let's just say we have not been overwhelmed and overrun with two projects going in right next to each other at the same time. So this is a new experience, I think, for us. But we've learned quite a bit, and I appreciate. I think Councilmember Fenter mentioned the patience, the understanding this is a new process for us, and I know it is for most everybody. But we've learned a lot, and I'm excited about what we're gonna see when they're both finished. Okay. I would, on this case, usually would just nod heads, but if we could have a formal motion that provides direction to staff to move ahead with the negotiation of the MOU, Councilmember Glover. We have a motion from Councilmember Glover, a second from the Vice Mayor. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Councilmember Higgins, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
Okay. Any opposed? Motion is unanimous. Congratulations. Thank you for your trust and confidence in Mesa. And I commit to you that we won't let you down. We're going to work with you to get something that we all will be proud of. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much for your cooperation.
Thank
you.
We
really appreciate it.
All right, the next item on the agenda is to hear a presentation to discuss changes with the Mesa Convention and Visitors Bureau. I see Mr. Garcia making his way up to the front.
Good morning, Mayor, Council members, and it is indeed another gorgeous morning in Mesa. Joining me this morning is our new Vice President of Sales and Marketing, Kimberly Freer, who we stole from our friends down the street at the Greater Phoenix Convention and Visitors Bureau. I had to have her. She worked for me for about 5.5 years.
It seems to be a theme that's developing.
I think many, if
not
most of you...
apologize for that. Kimberly, right. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
I think many, if not most of you now, have had a chance to meet with Kimberly. And I think you'll find as you get to know her better that she's a very sharp, very aggressive destination sales and marketing person. Before I get into this, I just want to let you know how thrilled I am to be in Mesa. I'm really enjoying being a part of all of this tremendous growth and development directly related to this industry. It's remarkable. I mean, I've been in this business for 15 and a half years, and I've never seen this type of explosive growth directly related to this industry. And it's a testament to all the great work that you're doing. I'm also thrilled to be a part of a community where the mayor, the city council, the city manager, and his team get it, who understand the value of visitors and the dollars that they bring and how they help keep resident taxes lower and help enhance the quality of life for all of us 365 days out of the year. So, and it's this support from the city that makes all the difference in the world in a Convention and Visitors Bureau's ability to effectively sell and market the destination. So thank you for lending that all-important hand. As you can imagine, or as you would might expect, I've spent these first 4.5 months doing a tremendous amount of evaluating talent, evaluating our internal processes, procedures, our policies, and evaluating how we're going to market with our brand, with Mesa. And that starts first with our logo. That's not the brand. I want to make that clear. Right now we're just talking about the logo. But it's important. It's the first place to start because it's what everyone sees. It's in all of our printed materials. It's in our visitor guides, our rack brochures. It's on our website. And it's often in our advertisements. And so what we wanted to do, at least in this short term, was to make it a little bit easier on the eye and direct people to our visitor portal, the visitmesa.com website. And you see the evolution here at the bottom is kind of where we used to be. At the top are where we're printing and showing this brand, this logo going forward. And again, it's temporarily, as you know, and we'll get into a little bit later, we're going through a rebranding process. But it was also, actually back up a second. We also eliminated, as you can see, the marking of Convention and Visitors Bureau. Why did we do that? We did that because it's confusing. It's confusing to the consumer. It's confusing to the customer. People out there don't really know what a Convention and Visitors Bureau is. We're often confused with the Chamber of Commerce. We're often confused with being part of the convention center, and we just wanted to be clear in who we are and presenting what we do. We are Visit Mesa. We're in the business of building visitation to Mesa. And the word bureau itself denotes bureaucracy and red tape, and that's not what we are. We are first and foremost a destination sales and marketing organization. Next slide. Mm-hmm. The next slide you see is our newly adopted vision and mission statements. The mission statement isn't new. We had a mission statement before. We just felt it needed to be freshened up. The vision statement is brand new to this organization, and we did this for three reasons. First, because we felt it was it was responsible for us to clearly state our vision and who we are and what we do and what we plan to be going forward. But we also incorporated the vision statement because we were publishing the business development plan that you find in front of you, and also because next fiscal year we'll be going into a process of certifying our organization through what's called our parent organization, Destination Marketing Association International, DMAI, formerly called the International Association of Convention and Visitors Bureaus. They have a certification process for CVBs. It's called Destination Marketing Accreditation Program, and I'm trying to spell things out because I understand that using acronyms are sort of a no-no.
We got that memo.
It's not that it's a no-no. It can just get quite expensive.
Yeah, I understand that.
Okay.
And so we'll be going through that process. It's quite a time-consuming process, pretty laborious process. It allows you to go through a number of examining all of your internal process, procedures, making sure you have an emergency preparedness action, and a number of things. One of those things is having a vision statement, so I felt it was important as we developed the business development plan to also incorporate our vision statement. Also, during this evaluation process, I began to look at the structure and the balance of the organization. What you see here is our new organizational chart. Obviously, in that blue box there is the reflection of Kimberly Freer, our new VP of Sales and Marketing. But a few other changes. Off to the left, you see the Director of Administration. Many of you may know Gail Savo on our staff, our office manager. She was effectively operating as a Director of Administration, handling all of our human resources, our operations, and finance, and this title is now a reflection of what she was doing. Director of Sales, Director of Marketing, no changes there, either in title or in the personnel who fill those positions. Off to the right, Director of Communications. Many of you know Michelle Streeter, who does an outstanding job. I'd put her up against anyone in this business in communications. Her former title is Director of PR. Felt that was a little bit limited in scope. Communications is a much more broader scope, and so we've changed her title as such. Below in the gray boxes, the sales manager positions, those were formerly development manager positions. We need to make sure that in this marketplace, we need to be aggressive salespeople, and I felt that sales needs to be in the title. So we made that change as well. And then finally, we had an assistant position. Sales formerly had two assistants underneath sales. We moved one out to be a marketing and communications assistant to provide some balance in the organization, all the great work that's being done in marketing and communications. So what's the new guy doing in terms of marketing and sales? We're doing quite a bit. I didn't realize how much until we started putting pen to paper. I think by now you've all seen the great light rail wrap we have rolling in Denver, which is seen by 400,000 riders a month. This is called guerrilla marketing, and it's something we've never done in Mesa, and we were kind of sick and tired of Denver doing it to us in this marketplace, so we thought we'd do it back to them. Little mixed on the results. Right now we have a little over 200 click-throughs from this. We're also, by the way, in 10 additional light rail cars with posters inside with QR codes. But it's still early. It's still not that yet cold in Denver. It's during the election. People's attention is elsewhere right now. We think that after the election, we'll start to see some more action directly related to click-throughs.
I will tell you, I was up in Denver for a quick trip late recently, and we're sitting there in the Hyatt in Denver, which the restaurant is at street level, and the light rail goes literally right past off the sidewalk, passes by there, and all of a sudden everyone at the dinner started yelling at me, here it comes, as they could see from like a block away the car coming, because they'd been there the day before, and all they could tell me about was the Mesa cars. And so we were sitting there, and I ran outside to grab a picture. So I got a couple pictures of the Mesa cars. Everybody thought we were completely well, maybe it's because I ran out an emergency exit and the alarm went off. I had to get the picture.
It was an emergency.
It was an emergency. That's right.
Well, thank you for that.
But I can tell you that that there are people who noticed that, and it was a lot of fun to see this going through downtown Denver.
That's great. Oh, excellent. That's terrific. And obviously, Denver is very important to us with the Frontier Service. So we're complementing this with a banner ad campaign, which will be using the multiple OTCs, the online travel companies in the business, the Orbitz, the Travelocities, the Expedias. And we'll be hitting that market right after the election. We've been in market quite a bit on all sides from a marketing standpoint, from a sales standpoint. We've held sports sales missions there. We've had a communications PR mission there. So we're really making a strong commitment to that Denver market because we know how important it is for this Frontier Service to be successful. And just generally speaking, from a marketing standpoint, we're trying to make sure that we're being able to track everything that we do that wasn't being done before. And it's important for us when we're trying to demonstrate a return on your investment into us to be able to demonstrate exactly the type of work we're doing and what those results are. And so we're doing a lot of unique URLs related to our several campaigns on a number of different levels, and also trying to determine exactly where the interest and where the bookings are coming from. Next slide. From a communication standpoint, again, you have the business development plan in front of you. We're pretty proud of it. It's the first time we've ever produced a full comprehensive business development plan. And it's our program of work for the year. It is our roadmap. And it's particularly important to our destination partners, the hotels, the attractions. Right now, they are in the midst of putting their budgets together. They're on a calendar year, and they're putting their plans together. And we just want to make sure that we're working all in concert with one another. We have a couple new newsletters that are going out to primarily our key stakeholders, to our destination partners. The Visit Mesa Insider is a monthly piece. It's really tracking the results, our performance, the things that we're doing, our travel schedules. The MVP, or the Mesa Visitor Profile, the first one will be released next week. It is more of a 30,000-foot level look at our industry, national trends, regional trends, issues that are facing the visitor industry, and how that translates and how those might impact the local visitor industry. It's much more of a numbers piece, a statistical piece, and certainly an advocacy piece. And we're going to be getting into that space a lot more. As you may know, I'm a registered lobbyist. I regularly attended the tourism lobbyist meetings that were bi-monthly during the legislative session. It's important for Mesa to have a seat, to have a voice, and to be there, and I will be at those meetings. And then new markets from a communication standpoint, Denver, as I mentioned, and the Pacific Northwest, and international powwow. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. There is one day during that show where there's a media component. From a sales perspective, when I first arrived, one of the things that became apparent to me right away was the very limited scope and ability of our internal customer relations management system, our CRM system. This is the system that houses all of the information about our clients. It's the system from which we distribute leads about clients to our destination partners. And it is the system from which we generate reports, all kinds of reports. And unfortunately, it just isn't as reliable as it should be. And my staff now knows well that numbers better never, ever, ever move. And they can't move, and we need to make sure we have a reliable database system in place. So we're doing that. We'll have one in January. We're in the process of moving all the data over from our current system into the new one. It's web-based, and it will be able to generate the types of reports that we need. We secured the Small Market Meetings Conference. SMMC will be here in September of 2014. That's a terrific success for our destination. And that is the equivalent of hosting 100 clients here. It's the equivalent of a big FAM. You may have heard of a FAM, a familiarization tour. There'll be 200 people here. They'll be staying at the Hilton, the Marriott, and the Hyatt Place, and they'll be utilizing the convention center for their meetings. But it is the equivalent of bringing 100 meeting planners, clients, into our market to take a look at what we have. So it's an opportunity to sell even more business or book more business. from travel industry sales. The most important thing we can be doing, and this is Kimberly's background, is to strengthen our partnerships with our key tour operators, U.S. Airways Vacations, Southwest Vacations, Allegiant, and BA Holidays. Powwow, I told you I wouldn't talk about that. Powwow is the largest industry trade show there is for the leisure market, for both domestic and international tour operators. We think that we'll have at least 35 to 40 leads generated from that trade show alone, which would by far surpass any other show that we attend. And as far as TIS is concerned, we'll be developing packages. There is a day during Powwow, it's the first day, it's a Monday, that's Mayor's Day, Mr. Mayor, and Mr. would Mayor. Love to have you join us. We'll be sure to get with you, try to get that on your calendar, love to have you join us. It's in Las Vegas in June.
You know, one thing that I just want to interject really quickly as it relates to travel industry sales, what we've done is we've shifted our print advertising campaigns and a lot of the things we're doing to have call to action. And the call to action is actually partnering with these tour operators who are housing our hotels on their site for booking. So we actually will have a call to action so the community will be able to see the benefit of the advertising programs. Instead of just branding and communicating Mesa, we'll actually have the ability for the client, the end user, consumer to actually book a holiday here. So that's a shift as well.
And sports, you may have heard by now that we will have LPGA presence in Mesa. I booked the R.R. Donnelly Founders Cup, and Phoenix developed a great relationship with their tournament director. And when I left, I said, you know, we're going to bring an LPGA event out to Mesa. And he's helped us do that. It isn't a regular tour event, I must say. This is part of the what's called the Futures Tour. It's now called the Symetra Tour. But at least it gets our feet on the ground. It gets us a foothold with LPGA. It'll be held at Longbow the last full week in February. We're very, very excited about that. We'll have 140 golfers plus their caddies. It's not a huge room night generator, but it really, again, the entire effort here is to elevate our brand. I think this does that for us. We are quickly becoming the mecca for swimming for the entire western part of the United States with Skyline and with Keno. And USA Swimming Grand Prix event, which has 800-plus athletes that will be here. We have that contracted for the next 4 years. We'll be here in April over the next 4 years. What's fantastic about this, number one, we're presenting sponsors. So Visit Mesa will be branded, and it's going to be televised on Universal Sports. Tough Mudder.
Yeah, Mark.
Yes.
Kavanaugh, sorry about that.
Just a question about the Grand Prix. What's the caliber or nature of the swimmers that will be coming to this event?
These are your future Michael Phelps type of caliber. These are the elite athletes, the most elite athletes, the athletes that are competing to get into the Olympics.
Great. Thank you.
And by the way, you see visitmesa.com Gateway Classic. Again, we're going through a rebranding process, and this process is evolving, and we're learning new things in this process. So you may not see that exact title in there. It may change, so just a heads up there. Tough Mudder, a fantastic new five-year contract with exposure to Eastmark. We're targeting right now USA Boxing, USA Weightlifting, great summer business in our convention center. We're negotiating with them right now. They have a pretty hefty bid fee that they're asking for, and we're trying to negotiate, find other ways to get them here. But it would be great to have that presence in Mesa in the summer. And we're developing a fantastic relationship with your parks department. I need to commend you and your parks director, Mark Hirschberg. Work very closely with him and with our team and doing a lot of fantastic things together to book business. Next page. We've held two strategic planning sessions, one with the hotel community. We held that last month. And we held another one with our board of directors just this last Friday, and Carrie was kind enough to join us. NGT stands for Nominal Group Technique. This is the process by which we hold these strategic planning sessions. I'm a big fan of that process. It's a process by which you've all been a part of a lot of different strategic planning sessions, and it's typically the most vocal person or vocal people in the room to get their ideas across. This is the format that sort of mitigates that and really builds true consensus. And it was interesting, through both of these processes, the number one objective, the number one priority that they ranked was rebranding this destination, which is fantastic because it only validated some of the things that we were already doing. We are in the process right now of going through that rebranding. The first process is auditing your current brand. And we have contracted with a brilliant destination marketing expert, Jeff Maraglia, who's actually behind us here. Jeff has the process of auditing is making sure you have a number of different stakeholder interviews, and he's been doing these one-on-one for the past month. He's now in his second phase. He did about 20 two or three weeks ago. He's in market now to finalize those. Many of you in this room have visited with him. I appreciate you taking the time to do that. The purpose of it is to find out who we want to be. Who are we? What's our story? Where have we been? Where are we going? And that's the purpose of this audit. And Jeff has received some many new, interesting, unique impressions from those visits. We will conclude the audit process by getting impressions from consumers, from clients. So we have a survey that's actually going out. Was it yesterday? It's going out this morning to our clients, to tour operators, to meeting planners. It's also going directly out to our consumer database to get as much feedback as we can about other people outside this market, what their impressions are of Mesa. And it helps us build our brand identity, our brand story going forward. And finally, by the way, let me back up. The process is, so we'll finish that. Jeff will be making a presentation to my board of directors November the 20th with his results, with his recommendations. The next process is we will be establishing a brand development advisory council made up of key representatives throughout the community, cross-section of the community. Certainly someone from the city of Mesa will be on that advisory council. We made up of people from the golf industry, our hotels, outdoor recreation, attractions, and other destination partners. And they will field the responses to the RFP that we issue for the creative. So we move from the audit to an RFP for creative, and then we'll be able to unveil, hopefully, the timeline for this is May or June of 2013. We'd love to have our coming out party, if you will, at the International Powwow Conference in June in Las Vegas. And finally, changing our name officially from the Mesa Convention and Visitors Bureau to Visit Mesa. I feel comfortable in sharing that now. It hasn't officially been done. The board will vote on it next month, but I've visited with all of them individually. We've been talking about it since my arrival in June, and everyone is on board. It will definitely pass. And again, we're changing the name to state our brand more clearly, to state who we are more clearly to the consumer. I mean, our industry, you know, other destinations, or even our clients in the sports market or meetings market, they know who a Convention and Visitors Bureau is, but the average person out there doesn't know what a Convention and Visitors Bureau is. So let's just call ourselves what we are and what
but
we
But it sounds so wonderfully bureaucratic. I don't know why you'd want to move it.
So that's
I think it's a great move because, Visit Mesa is active. The other thing, and, you know, nothing wrong with it, but it's just, it's a bureau.
It is. And to be
Visit
clear.
Visit Mesa shows activity and excitement, so
right.
Good
and,
move.
And just so it's clear, even though we're changing our name to Visit Mesa, it doesn't mean that that's what our brand is going forward. Yeah. It doesn't mean that that necessarily is what our story is going to be, and that's unfolding now. We're developing that now. It may, but it may not. So I just wanted to throw that out there. And then finally, last slide, our renovation. Our chairman, Gary Levine, was here a few months ago to talk about this. This is a slide that you've seen before. Where are we in the process? Our boardroom and our conference room are currently gutted. We think we're about a month out from the lobby and the boardroom and the conference room being open. And at that time, we will then break ground on the lobby. We're really excited about this. I think you know that we're moving a lot of those old brochures that were kind of cluttered in the lobby, and we're moving to touch screens that'll be on the wall. We've already uploaded all of our brochures online, so we'll have an online a wireless printer there that people can just click a button and print that brochure. We know that there are still people who want that hardcover brochure. Some of those will still be available, but we'll be phasing out of that as more and more people are very comfortable with technology. But that's the extent of the presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions. And if you have any questions specifically about the brand audit, Jeff Maraglia could also come up here as well.
Any questions? No, really. And I was thumbing through your the book here. That's pretty exciting. I appreciate the fact that you really focus on the whole picture. People forget, for example, that the Tonto National Forest is not a short drive from Mesa. It we border it. I mean, we are the only community that actually borders the Salt River when it's actually running, the riparian Salt River, other than, Salt River Pima. We're the only city. And so it's great that, you know, all these scenes and the things that just scream Arizona, everything are in our backyard. They're not some distant dream. They're right there.
So. Absolutely. And in fact, most everyone that Jeff has been speaking to, because he's been downloading me on all these interviews, is regionalism.
Yeah.
And that will be very much a focus.
Which is another thing... And it's one thing I wanted, and I don't know what the answer is. It's something we'll evolve into, but I noticed in the book you talked about the regionalism, especially with the Gateway and the coordination with Gilbert and Queen Creek. And, you know, I don't know. I don't have an answer. It's just an observation. I know that Gilbert, for example, has struggled with a little bit as to who would handle some of their promotion, what they would do. I'm not, you know, the town of Queen Creek doesn't have that I know of. A visitors bureau or whatever. Have we had any discussions with them as far as us helping, taking over, coordinating, whatever we want? Because there's no doubt that, you know, this is a cool little regional thing, whether you go out to the Queen Creek Olive Company or Schnepp Farms or Field of Dreams. You know, there's a lot of stuff that is our East Valley centric that are real attractive that we all share.
I'm going to let Jeff address this in just a second, but to answer your question specifically as it relates to have we spoken with anyone with the town of Queen Creek or the town of Gilbert? No, not officially. We've certainly had active engagement with a lot of the attractions in those regions, but we haven't had any meaningful discussions yet about representation.
Yeah, and I'm not throwing out any proposals or anything, but it seems like there's a natural evolution, and somehow we'll have some coordination. I have no idea what form that will take. I'm not trying to tell them we're taking over the town of Gilbert or Queen Grant. I know there's a sensitivity there, but it would seem like there's this, especially with Gateway, and Gateway being driven by, right now, leisure, soon hopefully a more of a mix, but right now there's no doubt that the passengers that come into Gateway are for the most part leisure passengers. If they're landing in our neighborhood, there's a lot to offer for them to stay in our neighborhood. It would seem natural that we'd somehow create some sort of joint efforts, and I don't know how that would play out or not, but I'd encourage you to continue that, exploring that, and see what we can do. Okay, go ahead, Jeff.
Mr. Mayor, thank you for giving me the opportunity in City Council. I really appreciate the opportunity, especially the opportunity for meeting most of you, and I still have some work to do to meet all of you. I had the opportunity to meet many, many different stakeholders, and the process continues to be enlightening. There's quite a bit of insight relative to just not visitation, but how it affects, you know, economic development and how a brand could affect both. We're looking at many different things, regionalization, but more importantly, we talk about the assets and the building of a new library and the art center and what's happening all over this entire region. See, there's an energy, and there's great enthusiasm. The brand needs to be all about what it is that provides that energy and make sure that energy becomes a message for visitors looking at it from the outside in. I lived in the area for over 15, close to 20 years. I built some brands that are pretty well respected throughout the country. And I'm coming back here, and I'm actually making Mesa my home. So if I look at what's happening, I can understand the enthusiasm that on everyone's faces and in everyone's voices. I see that those perspectives, impressions, thoughts, ideas that have been cultivated for well over 30 to 50 years, it's time for us to get out there and start telling the rest of the world who we are the right way, not just what we have, but who we are as a community, as a people, as a voice, and what we're going to bring to the new world, to the new societies, to the new experiences that people are going to have, that Mesa and our region could own and tell a truthful and authentic story.
Well, thank you. I don't think you have to do any convincing here. I think if you've seen what we've been up to recently, and even this morning with the Goldwater thing,
it just adds to it.
You got a group of people here who have been on board with that for a long time. Exciting to see you pick that up and take it to the next level. So thank you.
You bet.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Council.
Okay. Next item on the agenda is to hear a presentation discuss the Fire and Medical Services Department Dispatch Agency's Valley-Wide Automatic Aid System. I know that was a tough act to follow, Chief, but I'm sure you can create dispatch in an as exciting manner as we can.
Both of those presentations are almost historic. So, but you know, Mayor and Council, good morning. It is a nice segue, though, because what we're going to talk about in terms of fire service is probably one of the most expansive and active regionalization efforts that's going on here in the Valley and in many places across the country. The purpose of the presentation this morning is to bring to you an automatic aid agreement that we've been working off of for many years, but we have been updating recently. Some of it is just routine housekeeping update. And some of it has to do with sort of preparing for the future and possibly being able to manage our assets and our coordination a little bit tighter than we have been to in the past. As you know, there's over 25, if we start with the slide presentation, there's about 25 agencies that are considered automatic aid. Four of them are here in Mesa. Thanks, Joe. Thank you. Yeah, I can do that. As you can see, there are the vast majority of communities here in the Valley are participants in automatic aid. We also have many associate members, which are basically mutual aid participants. In mutual aid, what we're talking about is a situation that's obviously not automatic, because automatic means a lot of things, which I'll cover some this morning, but mostly what it means is that there is an automatic dispatch to any jurisdiction for any need that should occur. Typically, it's bordering communities and things like that, as you would imagine. But mutual aid is actually where somebody has to pick up a phone, make a contact with the other community, and say, can you send XYZ resources to help with this specific incident at this location? So there's no shared dispatch there, so there's nothing automatic about that. So there's a little bit of a delayed response. There's a lot of reasons for some communities not to participate in automatic aid, because we have the standard level of service delivery and response that we protect very closely. Also, one of the requirements is that we have contiguous borders. So some of these areas, we do not have contiguous borders. And then in other cases, these communities simply don't choose to participate in automatic aid just by their own decision. The objectives this morning are, the objectives of automatic aid are consistently dispatch the closest, most appropriate unit in the region, which we've been doing for many years. Mesa and Phoenix are the only two dispatch entities in the region that participate in the system. And we coordinate very closely together. As you can imagine, especially as two dispatch entities, it's important that we understand automatic aid and that everybody in the system understands it, so that we can dispatch consistently with high level of service, with good response times, and safety for the firefighters and improved service for the community. The clarification of one of the purposes of this is to clarify the dedicated resources for reciprocal response. And the reason for those, as I just mentioned, is uniform, high level service to the community, as well as firefighter safety. Other encouragements have to do with procedures and protocols. We operate in an incident management system that is consistent throughout this region. The training is consistent. The terminology is consistent. The way the apparatuses are equipped and staffed is consistent. So when we dispatch in the automatic aid region, it really is like one large response system, because anybody in the system from Surprise to Queen Creek, if we send a fire truck, they know, the incident commander in that community knows exactly what they're getting when they request an engine company, or exactly what they're getting when they request a ladder company. So this process helps standardize a lot of that. There's a lot of effort put in. We meet quarterly. Life Safety Council, Mesa and Phoenix are the only permanent members of the executive board for that group. And then we also have two members of the East Valley, two members of the West Valley on the executive board. We meet monthly. So there's quite a bit of effort and coordination that goes into making sure that this whole process runs smoothly. One of the issues that we deal with from time to time is one of the things and I know council has asked the questions before, one of the prime objectives for us, for our individual communities, is to be sure we have equity in the system. And so we put a lot of effort and analysis into managing that process. This document includes a provision where if a community was to reduce their ability to participate in automatic aid as it's currently agreed, that they would give us 120 days notice. And the main purpose for that is that we think we can solve the problems. I'm sure you guys must be aware that as we go through the day, fire trucks and fire stations go up and down for training and lots of different purposes. Well, as a regional deployment system, we move resources around to maximize the coverage. And we can do that on an incidental basis. But for a community to reduce their capability because of whatever reason to a particular area is something that we want to monitor. The other thing we do well is train our troops the same. We educate them. Health and safety is a big deal for us. We try to do that on a regional basis as well. This opportunity in terms of open contracts from cities, especially Phoenix and Mesa, who put probably more research and development time into decisions than some of the other smaller departments are capable of. We allow them to use our information, our specs for fire trucks, right on down to specs for self-contained breathing apparatus and other equipment, and as well as recruit training standards and things of that nature. So there's a very high degree of consistency within the resources within the automatic aid system, which makes it very, very predictable.
Hey, Chief.
Sir?
On the list, of either the members or the associate members, I don't see Rural Metro. Now, you know, we have very large county islands, Leisure World, Dreamland, and all the areas out in the east and southeast that are covered by Rural Metro. How do we manage that relationship right now? I'm assuming we do answer when there is need and there is assistance if there's a major incident in a county island.
Correct. There's an interesting dynamic, essentially a civics dynamic, where integrating private enterprise with tax-supported services. We're very careful to make sure that the integrity of both of those processes are maintained. But in the process of doing that, we do dispatch the ambulances for Southwest Ambulance. And in our region, we do that. Phoenix Fire dispatches incrementally, as you're aware of, we have the first regional system for ambulances. So we do include them in the medical response, but in the fire response, it's a mutual aid relationship. If we need them, we call them. If they need us, we call them.
Okay.
But they call us, and so
it's not an automatic. It's on an as needed to cover that.
Okay. Yeah, that's correct. And we respond when we do respond. We respond typical to the way the automatic aid region responds.
Right.
Many times they don't have the resources, and their response times are longer. Sometimes we'll respond, although less frequent, we'll respond in lieu of them because their response time would be so crazy.
Right.
And when you consider that a lot of our calls are not necessarily in residences, for the EMS component in particular, you know, Mesa residents and residents of other communities are in and around the area all the time, and so You know, as much as we have jurisdictional boundaries, the people don't understand jurisdictional boundaries, but they still deserve the service that they've paid for through their taxes.
Does Rural Metro have, do they just have the one station there on Power near University? Do they have is that the only one they have in the eastern part? Do they have a couple? Yeah. Alex?
Yeah.
One at about 100th Street and University also, oh, okay. And then right. Some a little farther south.
Okay.
But, good. Mayor, if I could tag on to that, sure. It's interesting in the new District 2 that borders Leisure World, which is a county island, and also Dreamland Villa on the other side. These kind of issues, I appreciate the mayor bringing it up, are going to be interesting as they evolve down the road. Those are two very dynamic, modern retirement communities, but yet... you know, in the scope of things, and we have, I think we've occasionally get called in there to really assist in some large, you know, roaring house fires, things that go on long. And so it's interesting to, I've had some conversations on the Rural Metro side. I've visited with the chief and figuring out what's the best way to take care of that situation and how we provide mutual aid and fire protection and other things. So definitely topics for future conversation and how we evolve. So thanks.
Councilor Kavanaugh.
Yeah, and to follow up on that point, we have a lot of areas in the eastern part of our city that are county islands that I think are currently served by Rural Metro. And I'm wondering about the situation. What would happen if the private company makes a decision based on whatever reasons to say, well, we're not going to provide fire service to those county islands. It's not profitable for us anymore. What does that do for us? What would your department have to do? What would you be able to do if that scenario would ever happen?
Well, you may recall in the last several years, state statute was changed to allow non-contiguous bordered county islands to form a fire district. So what we would do, and I believe Rural Metro would assist us in this, as they have assisted Gilbert, is to put together a district framework for these communities. The other option is, of course, they could annex if council was to approve that, and we could provide service in those areas. And I think that's a little bit of what Alex is talking about in terms of the dynamics are fluid. And so we're sort of, in fact, we're doing some, we're looking at several different models. In fact, we're going to do it again this afternoon of what we may be able to encourage if something like this was to evolve and what the phases may be for maintaining the service levels. But we have a general philosophy that we operate under is that if we get a 911 call, we're going to respond if we're the most appropriate agency to do that in terms of a response time. Now, we don't do that routinely. We will do our best to contact the proper agency for that response. But at the end of the day, we're really about public safety, and so we will. But we have to manage that. Again, it's an equity issue, and especially with Rural Metro, it's more than that. We have to be careful not to subsidize with public money, and I think we've done a good job of that over the years because, as you know, Rural Metro is, they're clearly the largest private fire protection and EMS company in the country. And they own and operate heavily within our region. So we've actually interacted with them quite well. We have what we call mutual disengagement procedures, where if we were to respond with them or maybe get there before them and initiate action on an incident, we have procedures on how we would back out of the incident and they would transition into the lead role so that we separate ourselves, get our units back to our jurisdiction, and cover our areas as a priority.
So, Chief, can I maybe explain? I believe the understanding of how they finance.
Rural Metro is not, there isn't necessarily, is there a subscription or do they pay them per the incident?
There's basically, the model is three approaches. One is, and the one they like the best, is to contract with a community or a fire district. The other is they have subscriptions, they are very active in selling those subscriptions, and I think that's probably the strongest part of their business. But they do have the ability to respond even if there is no contract in place and then bill the occupant for the cost of that response.
And the reason I asked that question, that's what the challenge, I guess, it gets to us. If we're in there responding, someone's getting billed for our services. And so it's kind of we don't want to... It's a public safety issue first, but then it becomes also kind of a business issue at some point in that response. So I think our folks have done a very good job trying to balance that out, but it puts us in an awkward position.
I think the reality is, and we don't know what Rural Metro has planned unless they've told us that, and I haven't heard about it, we have to assume two scenarios. Number one, that they will continue to provide services in those county islands, and number two, that there may be some day that they decide not to provide those services. I mean, that those are just the realities, and I appreciate the fact that it sounds like we're dealing with the existing in a way that balances the needs for public service with also, frankly, the fact that we shouldn't be in the business of subsidizing those who don't live in the city. And I know that sometimes that's a tricky balance, but there's a reason people live in the county, the reason people live in the city. The other thing, though, is to be forward-thinking, especially looking at some of the difficulties that, you know, like Gilbert had and others, when that transition was not as clean as it could have been. Now, granted, we have a new law, which hopefully will help ease some of the difficulties that Gilbert went through, because they didn't have that framework in place when they went through their transition. And so, in fairness to them, we have a much better framework in which to work. But still, I can't imagine that that's, if that were to happen, whether it's next week, next decade, that that's going to be a seamless or smooth type of thing, because there's a lot of thoughts we have to do just from a sheer capacity standpoint. You know, you talk about Leisure World, Dreamland Villa, some big tracks with a lot of people with a lot of needs, especially medical needs, and you know, so we have some resource allocation issues that I think we need to be looking forward to anticipating that day, and I hope that Rural Metro is successful and provides great service for as long as they possibly can. I think that's in everyone's best interest. But I appreciate the fact that you got both those things on the radar.
Mayor, the problem goes beyond just simply providing the service. There are infrastructure issues out there as well that will impact the ability to provide that service. A lot of that area doesn't have water, fire hydrants. The roads are questionable. The culverts don't support the type of apparatus. I mean, rural, truly rural, a lot of these areas are very rural. And rural fire protection is far different than urban fire protection.
That's what I mean. The fact is that if Rural Metro pulls out and there's nobody there to provide that, we have to plan
well,
for that day.
Well, I think we have.
How do we transition?
I think the first conversation is with the county.
Yeah, well, that's what
good
I mean.
Good luck with it, but they don't keep track of it.
Well, but the challenge is that the county has to be, if the business of the county is to allow development in the county islands, and they're the ones that set the standards. And that yet if it's a standard that doesn't allow us to go provide service without putting, my biggest fear is, you know, everything you just said, it's putting our men and women in harm's danger, because now if they're having to run hoses and go in without water, water resource.
Well, and you also don't know what's out there, because I don't know who's doing any inspections.
My point is,
all.
In some other states I've worked in, within a certain distance from a city boundary, there were a different level of development standards that were required by the county, so
there
that.
Were standards, you mean?
Oh. But I mean,
it would help mitigate.
You know, we get, and this is something going forward. The fact is that the fact is whether it's on a mutual aid or something, we deal with this situation right now. And were Rural Metro, for whatever reason, to move out next year, we would have to deal with that situation. I mean, we can talk about what the county has or hasn't done, and I hope that going forward we can lobby to get them to at least take into account when they are approving such. And I think it's a different story now than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. Fact of the matter is, though, East Mesa has a heck of a lot of buildings that were built 15, 20, 30 years ago. And, you know, if there's a fire, we can't. We have to recognize, we have to accept the situation it is, and eventually prepare for that time, because that's, I think that's a reality we're going to hit. I hope it's later rather than sooner. I'm not really that thrilled about taking on that kind of a responsibility next week, but I appreciate the fact that we're looking forward, not looking forward, that sounded like we're excited about it, but we're forward looking and recognizing that may be a challenge that we have. I agree with you. I think if we ever do get that we'll have plenty of notice, and Rural Metro will work for a good transition. And I have heard nothing. I don't want anyone to think that they've told me any secrets. So I'm assuming they're going to be there, for as long as they can, because I haven't heard anything otherwise. But I think we need to be looking forward.
Mayor,
I appreciate the fact that you are doing that.
As you guys would imagine, when the state law passed that allowed for the non-contiguous county island districts, we were very anxious about what possibly could occur with our two large county islands. Although the focus at the time was in Gilbert, we knew with that possibility that could occur. At that time, in the discussions we had with Rural Metro, they felt like it was still profitable for them to serve in those two county islands. But we have an agreement with them, although not written, but we have an agreement that says...
Good faith agreement.
A good faith agreement, yeah. There you go, that well before they would anticipate pulling out of an area as densely populated as those two county islands, that we would, they would be on board with us to figure out a transition.
And it's not like we don't have a substantial relationship with Rural Metro because,
right.
You know, Southwest Ambulance being a subsidiary of Rural Metro, right. They are Rural mm-hmm. Metro. So, you know, we have a great relationship with Rural Metro.
We do.
Because through our long stand, not only the fact that our paths cross so often, but with our long-term relationship with Southwest Ambulance. And we showed that with the regional ambulance agreement. So I'm not concerned about that. It's just the reality. I mean, I can see us, I don't know, in the future of having to have desert firefighting things because, you know, that development's not going to change overnight. You're still going to have to go down a dirt road to prepare to go down a dirt road to fight a thing, which is why Rural Metro has some of the equipment they have, because they fight in different circumstances than we do. And that those are just things that are long-term. I appreciate the fact that you're looking at them and their discussions that will continue to have, because I guess what I'm trying to say is if that day were ever to happen, I have full confidence that we won't be caught off guard. It won't be a surprise to us. We'll be prepared to handle that.
That's
so
right.
I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mayor.
Any
more questions
for the chief? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Changing the trucks for Mayor.
What's that?
I'm just poking at Alex.
That's what I figured.
No, we want to move forward, not backward. Next item is to hear a presentation to discuss ThinkSpot at Red Mountain Library.
We were envisioning a space where residents of all ages could go to learn, create, innovate, and collaborate. Because of the citizen feedback that we received, we decided to submit it as an innovation with impact, and it was funded as part of the budget process. So over the last couple of months, we've been researching and designing the space, and while the name has changed to ThinkSpot, our goals remain the same. We're looking to create a very highly adaptable space where our citizens can go and have access to a collaborative workspace, meeting space, technology, and receive the benefit of community education and instruction. These are aerial views of the space. For those of you who have been to the Red Mountain Library, we're taking two meeting rooms that mirror each other, and we're removing the wall that divides them to create about 2,200 square feet of space. That's one of the major pieces of construction happening. We're also creating a video production lab, and you can see in the picture here, it projects out into the library. We want to create interest, bring people into the space, get them excited about the space. So that is one part of the plan. On the ends, we have meeting rooms. You can see from here that they have glass folding doors, so we can separate them from the larger space and have one large meeting room, or we can even divide it further into two small meeting rooms. And then the other end, you can see for the aerial view, and I'll have some better views, is where our hackerspace is located. And that'll be a long counter space where we have the equipment and workspace for people to use that technology. This picture here, you can
see.
Hacker space.
I think it's always good that we provide hacker space for.
So much for cybersecurity.
Explain that a little bit better.
We're training future hackers.
We are not training future hackers.
Oh, okay.
We are creating, another term is makerspace. We are creating a space where people can use 3D printers, laser cutters, and those sorts of equipment to create things. So, and I'm not sure where hackerspace came from, but it is one of the common terms, but makerspace probably conveys it better.
Not troublemaker space?
It's to keep people out of trouble. I like this slide because it does show the front entrance to the space. We're going to put more windows so people can see into the space. Hopefully they'll think, what's going on in there, and I want to go in, and we'll participate in the space. You can also see into the video sound recording lab, so as people are interacting in there, people can see. The bottom image is inside the interior. That wall that says ThinkSpot on it is the backside of the media lab, and you can see that it's a large open space. The furniture will all be on wheels. People can work individually. They can bring chairs and tables together to work as groups, and then we can move things around to provide instruction in the space. So again, we're just trying to be as flexible and multipurpose as possible in that space. And then you can see the far end, you can see the meeting rooms, and you can see the glass doors. And here's another view closer up of the meeting room space, and then the bottom image, you can see the counters and where we're going to have the equipment for the hacker space. And I'm moving fast because I know it's been a long meeting.
Heather, why don't you kind of go back, step back just a second and talk a little bit about kind of the targeted audiences that we've meant to kind of try to attract to the space between the schools, businesses, and entrepreneurs?
What we're trying to do is Amy Trethewey from Mesa Council College has been part of the team as well as engineering, and we're trying to create a space because we know libraries, and libraries do attract students, they do attract business people, but we're trying to create something a little bit different where we're hoping that students can come after school, work on group projects, or individually, and find the technology that they would find in the school. So if, for example, they don't have a computer at home to do PowerPoint presentation, they'll be able to come into this space and work with their group on that PowerPoint presentation and be prepared for the school day. We're also hoping that the business community will come in, use the space, you know, between meetings if they're on that side of town, or maybe they work at home and home isn't always the quiet workspace that they would like. They can come in here. They can meet with coworkers, clients. They have a nice meeting room where maybe we're planning on video conferencing technology. Just trying to be very collaborative, very open, and as Mr. Brady knows, we're also trying to let, we're going to open the space and we're going to put information and technology out there. We're going to try to put some programs together, but we're also trying to let the community tell us what they need from the space, and it'll grow and develop organically based on the needs of the community.
So this was something we saw at Gangplank and some other places where it just kind of evolves as people
gathering
come
place.
Into a gathering place. It's interesting. Technology has allowed us to do a lot of work from our homes and, you know, and never leave the house. But people are finding out that that human connection and collaboration is also very important. And so this kind of community center
bridges that
makes
gap.
It helps bridge that gap. So that's
awesome.
The intention.
Yeah. And it fits right in with our innovation mode where we want people to be innovative, and although there are hackers who can be innovative from home, I like the idea that people can get together, and let's say they're working from home, but they need a place to gather. I think it serves that purpose. Great idea. Any other questions for Heather?
Yeah, Mayor.
Yeah, Dina, go ahead.
This is another example of, I want to commend Heather and her staff for continually evolving the library just to meet the needs of the community. And I mentioned it the other day when we were on our bus tour that, the Express Library, this event, other things she's doing with her staff with less resources and just more innovation, and I just think they do a great job.
Thanks for mentioning that. It's also, I like how it's the convergence of the IMESA ideal and process with the innovation of the library, and you come up with a great idea that's both community-driven and also staff city-driven to come up with something that works for everybody. That's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Report of job order contracts. Ms. Huning, are you in charge of this one?
Yeah.
Don't sound so excited.
Oh, I am excited this morning.
We're excited because this is about the last item on the agenda. So
we've got three items on today. One is the library that Heather just presented on. We've also, because we had these JOC contracts in place, we had a kind of a neat opportunity this last week where one of the playground vendors contacted our staff and asked if we'd be interested in partnering with them, they gave us a significant discount, over half off some playground equipment. If we could get it in and get it done really quickly so they could take pictures for their brochure and put us out in the national brochures. So about $200,000 in equipment for about $88,000, put it into Red Mountain Ranch. And because we had the JOC contracts, we could go really quickly, and so they get in time to get them their pictures. So
good.
That's also on, as well as we're renovating a storage room behind the around the Piper Theater into two restrooms. That's on the agenda as well. So three projects.
Good. Councilman Richens.
This falls under those contractors that we saw the list of.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And then,
so there's no action required because we already approved that.
Yeah.
This is reporting back.
Right.
Yeah.
This is part of our outreach.
But it's those contracting firms that are doing the work, or are they subcontracting out the work?
Both. Both. Right? Actually, our primary one has already had an outreach networking system with the local Mesa contractors, and we have goals on all of these, and they're putting Mesa-affiliated firms into the contracts as well.
I liked it was interesting seeing this, and I was curious about the park stuff. I was like, why are we putting new park stuff in one park and then taking the old stuff
showcase
and putting it in the old neighborhood? I was a little offended by that.
Actually,
but I understand now why that
Well, happened. Andrea's here, but the equipment that's at Red Mountain now is pretty gently used, and we want to take advantage of but the stuff in Rotary is kind of beyond its useful life.
Sure.
And as we remove it, we're going to re-dip it and paint it and put it over so it looks like, so it is new when it comes into. So.
The other thing I wouldn't mind seeing in this report is which contractor this is under, and then what subcontractors they, if that's been decided yet, should we see that kind of information with this, or
that's something I can report back on later.
Give you an update maybe as we get along with these.
In the weeds every time,
well,
but I'm just kind of curious.
I think once we
how this is working.
Issue this, we get this approval, then they'll go out and then they'll subcontract
it.
And maybe we need to give a report back about how they're doing as far as bringing in local businesses.
Right.
Because that's what I think that's what you're looking for, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to be transparent as possible with this.
No, we can fit, and we can put the, we can maybe by some code or something identify the contractor that this is going to. Okay.
We can get all that done for the next one.
Okay, Casper.
And one thing I love about this process: very open. We get to celebrate the huge savings in taxpayer dollars. Just real positive all the way that we're kind of going down this road and letting people know. So thank you.
I'm pretty excited. The equipment going into Red Mountain is pretty interesting equipment. It's very unique. A lot of rope climbing, a lot of spinning, and cool things.
Good. Okay. Thank you. Acknowledge receipts of minutes of various boards and committees. Have a motion from the Vice Mayor and Second Councilmember Glover. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Councilmember Higgins, how do you vote?
I vote aye, Mayor.
Okay. Motion carries. Here reports of meetings and conferences attended. Councilmember Cavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. I'd actually like to report on events that are going to occur in the next day or two. Webster Recreation Center, which is a city parks recreation facility, is having a Halloween carnival tomorrow night, October 26th, from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Got great staff and volunteers at the Webster Recreation Center. That's at 202 North Sycamore. And then Saturday in my district, the Dobson Library film series continues with Ghostbusters at 1:30 p.m. And rumor has it that one of our actual local Ghostbusters may make an appearance there and he will probably go through the library and vacuum up all the ghosts that we have there before the movie starts. But thank you, Mayor.
Okay. Councilor Richens.
Don't forget, I'm sure Chris will cover it, the day of service on Saturday. It's a big, big deal. And, I mean, I want to just give some credit to Michelle Alves at the beginning and how much work she's done working here. She's been here Friday, Saturday. I get emails from her at all times. It's just amazing. And so I think she just deserves some recognition for the great work.
We're going to let her get married the next
Michelle's
week.
Done, yeah, and she's planning a wedding the following
Figures
week.
I'm like, get married.
Oh, boy. Congratulations, Michelle. Thank you.
Councilmember Higgins, you want to report on the ribbon cutting?
Oh, the ribbon cutting, yes, of course. we had the wonderful opportunity to open yet one more fire station in the city of Mesa. So Fire Station 220 is on Main Street and 56th-ish, I think. And it was a very wonderful event. It's another great fire station that's going after LEED Gold certification. And we spoke about LEED today, so I don't have to define it again. And it's just another great day where we're expanding service to the residents in Mesa.
Great. Thank you. Vice Mayor.
Thank you. Councilwoman Higgins and I, as well as our fair city manager, took a bus tour on the brand new Route 277, which is our pilot route in East Mesa. This marks the first substantial public transit service east of Power Road. And I say it's substantial because there was a small leg of one of our routes did go east of Power Road. This one will go from the Superstition Springs Transit Center all the way out to along Baseline Road to Signal Butte, comes back up and to the Transit Center. We heard that the very first run of this route had a rider get on at 6 a.m., ride it to the end of line, took his bike and transferred over to the 40. So it was, I don't know who it was, but it was truly an intermodal type of passenger. So we had a rider. The route we did at 9 o'clock in the morning, the bus was full of folks who came out to ride it and do the tour of the route. So we're very interested in seeing what the numbers look like over the six-month pilot program, making some adjustments. We already had feedback come in about where we should maybe move a few of the bus stops and add one or two. So as long as we get that feedback coming in, we'll be able to hopefully add this to as a permanent route, either seasonal or otherwise, in the future. So we want people to get on that.
Great. Thank you. Anything else? I did a lot of things in last week, but one thing that I wanted to mention was I had an opportunity to address the capital chapter of the National Institute of Governmental Purchasing. Now, that doesn't sound very exciting, although we had a great representation from Ed Quedens and our staff. Yeah, okay, quit yawning. But the topic was really interesting. They asked me to talk about many of the buy local initiatives and the challenges that we have, especially here in Arizona, where Arizona's only one of three states that specifically does not have, and even in its state code, does not allow preferences for things like buy local. So how do you, what they wanted me to talk on was how do you implement a buy local strategy in light of the general environment? And that's something that I think all cities, because we want to support local business, we want to be regional, we want to be Arizona. That's all buy local. And so it was really sort of interesting, and getting my feedback from the staff, apparently the discussion is hotly debated within the purchasing, and we're seeing now with the job order costing and all that. There's quite a change in our whole approach to procurement, our policies, our philosophies, and so actually it turned out to be a very interesting conversation. And I appreciate it. Big crowd. I was here at the convention center. It was filled the ballroom there. So big crowd. So thanks to all who engaged in that discussion. It actually turned out to be very interesting. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. We have another busy weekend. Last weekend we had our Celebrate Mesa.
Wait, hold on. Before we go, nobody reported on that.
Dina, are you still here?
You want to report on the Celebrate Mesa?
Yes.
Do you want to talk about Celebrate Mesa?
I am. Celebrate Mesa, what an event. I was hearing numbers of 5,000 to 6,000 people attended.
Yep.
And I would believe that, but it was a large event at Red Mountain Soccer Complex. Kind of a lot Halloween kind of ish pageant, or what do we call that? Costume, whatever pageant. Lots of, climbing walls and zip lines and toys and candy, not toys, games and candy, and city staff that came out, in mass to represent, what their department does and answer any questions that residents have. But it's in lieu of City Hall and Wall. This was a huge event, and it was a wonderful evening.
And this is I know this isn't the second Celebrate Mesa.
It is.
First one we had was the 75th.
During the, right.
But it was basically the same type of
yes,
event.
Yes, correct.
All three of them have been incredibly successful.
Well, this is actually, you'd count it before, because we did two last year.
We did it Pioneer in Red Mountain, and we did it again this year, Pioneer Red Mountain. So it seems to be a very good event where we can attract, as Councilwoman Higgins says.
Well, the one thing I heard is that there was a challenge in parking, but that's not because there were too few spaces. It said there were too many people.
that's a great problem to have. I know. We'll keep working on it.
But that's great when you overflow the space that shows you it's real popular. So
it's a great event.
Okay. Mr. Brady.
So let's see. Today they'll be at 6:30. A neighborhood outreach office will be hosting an educational awareness meeting about roof rats at Ince Elementary School, located at 4132 East Adobe. I think that's getting a lot of attention. So hopefully, if residents
this
are concerned
was
about that,
not riffraff, it was roof rat.
Roof rat. And as Councilmember Kavanaugh was mentioning, this Saturday is National Make a Difference Day from 7 a.m. to noon. We have identified over 50 projects across the city of Mesa. We know that the executive team will be in District 6 helping out on a Eagle project for someone I know very well. And so we'll be at Guadalupe and Chrisman working on a project there. So we're excited about that. And there also Saturday, if you're not out working on a project, you can get your household hazardous waste out. There will be a collection event at the East Mesa Service Center. So we encourage everyone to bring out their electronics and appliances. And then also, it's a busy day Saturday, the Mesa Arts Center campus is hosting their 6th annual Dia de los Muertos, and that will include live entertainment, food, and a mercado with traditional and contemporary merchandise.
Good.
So our next study session will be November 1st. Thank you.
On the actual Dia de los Muertos. Okay, thank you. As the vice mayor told me that the great challenges of this century are roof rats and feral cats.
Why are you blaming me?
Because you said it. I'm giving you credit.
You'd be shocked at how symbiotic those two are.
Yes, they are. Somehow one attracts the other. I can't figure that out. And always a problem. Okay. Ms. Crocker, are there any requests to speak?
No requests, Mayor.
All right. I have a motion adjourned from Councilmember Kavanaugh, second from Councilmember Finter. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Thanks for calling me.
Aye.
Thank you, Dina. See you later.
See you later.